new online magazine, Compact, a radical American journal. I'm also president of the Bonum Communa Foundation, which is hosting tonight's event. The Bonum Communa Foundation is dedicated to advancing knowledge of Roman law, Greek philosophy, and Judeo-Christian religion as the triple foundations of Western civilization. It does this by promoting scholarship, offering educational programs for students and young professionals, and holding conferences and colloquia like tonight's event. I'm joined in this work by four friends and fellow Bonum Communa Foundation board members, Professor Chad Pecknold of the Catholic University, who's done most of the heavy lifting to put together tonight's event, as well as Professors Patrick Deneen of Notre Dame, who's featured on the panel, Radin Papin of the Matthias Corvinus Collegium in Budapest, and Adrian Vermeule of Harvard Law, who's, of course, tonight's featured speaker. In a moment, I will introduce our speakers and our plan for the evening. But first, I'd like to take this moment to thank a few of the Bonum Communa Foundation's donors who have made this event possible and are here to celebrate with us tonight. They are Mr. Patrick and Mrs. Robin Fennelly, Mr. Pedro Jose Izquierdo, and Mr. John Soriano. Thank you for your support. I'm also honored to recognize some of the dignitaries who are joining us in the audience. First of all, our foreign guest representing the Embassy of Hungary, Mr. Paul Schmidt, the Embassy's political director. The Honorable Cass Sunstein, former administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. Mr. Matthew Lee Wiener, acting chairman and executive director of the Administrative Conference of the United States. The Honorable John Demers, former U.S. Assistant Attorney General for the National Security Division. The Honorable Carlos Munoz, Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court. The Honorable April Ferris, Justice of the Texas First District Court of Appeals. Mr. Lucas Croslow, Deputy Solicitor General of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and the Reverend Father Jeffrey Langan of the Personal Prelature of Opus Dei. We can now get to our speakers and plan for the evening. Our featured speaker is, of course, Adrian. Adrian Vermeule is the Ralph S. Tyler Jr. Professor of Constitutional Law at Harvard Law School and a council member of the Administrative Conference of the United States. Before coming to Harvard, he was the Bernard Meltzer Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. He's the author or co-author of 11 books, most recently, Common Good Constitutionalism. He was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2012 and serves as a director of the Bonum Communa Foundation. Adrian will speak about his book for about 20 minutes, and then we will hear from our respondents on the panel for about 5 to 10 minutes each. Then Adrian will get 10 minutes to reply to his respondents. And although I'm a Persian, I'll do my best to enforce a Prussian discipline on this in the hope that we'll have time for one question from the audience. Because then after that, the National Press Club will ask us to adjourn. Now, permit me to introduce our respondents as well. First up, the Honorable Paul Meade. Judge Meade sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit in Philadelphia. Prior to joining the federal bench in 2019, Judge Meade served as an assistant U.S. attorney for his native New Jersey, as well as senior counsel and deputy chief counsel to the governor of the Garden State, and in private practice. Next, the Honorable Jeff Wall. Mr. Wall served as acting as Solicitor General of the United States and principal deputy Solicitor General under President Donald Trump. He's now a partner in the firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, where he also worked prior to his government service. After that, my friend Patrick J. Deneen. Patrick is a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. His books include Why Liberalism Failed, The Odyssey of Political Theory, Democratic Faith, and a number of edited volumes. Patrick is also a director of the Bonum Communa Foundation. Finally, the Honorable Judge Amul Fakhar. Judge Fakhar sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Prior to taking his seat on the federal appellate bench, Judge Fakhar worked in private practice and as an adjunct professor at the University of Cincinnati College of Law, and as an assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Ohio. Due to unforeseen and last-minute circumstances, Judge Fakhar couldn't join us in person tonight, but he will offer his response from an originalist point of view via video. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming our panelists and welcoming Adrian to the podium.
Well, thank you so much, Sorab, and thanks all of you for coming. I have a confession to make right at the outset. I remember remembered everything I needed except a copy of my book. So you're not allowed to ask me questions about it. I'd like to extend special acknowledgments to my family, to our special commentators and guests, Judge Mabee, Jeff Wall, Professor Deneen. Also, special thanks to those who traveled a long way to get here. And in this regard, I'd like to acknowledge Justice Harris from Texas and Chief Justice Williams from Florida. And last but not least, let me thank the President and colleagues who organized this event in conjunction with the Bowdoin Community Foundation. Now, you may or may not know that even as we speak, elsewhere in D.C., the big annual Libertarian Gala is getting underway. So on one view of liberty, you are free to attend either. On the true and correct view of liberty, liberty is the freedom to do what one ought to do. And what you ought to do is to attend an evening on the common good. So I'd like to congratulate you all for having recognized the path of duty and following. Okay, I'll basically try to do three things very briskly in this talk. This may be taking on too much, but here it goes. First, I'll try to sketch what common good constitutionalism is in positive terms. Second, I'll try to explain what it isn't, dispelling a few myths you may have encountered if you've fallen into bad company somewhere. Third, I will end with some thoughts about why there's been a resurgence of interest in the classical legal tradition, especially in my experience among younger lawyers, that is, law clerks and law students in particular. Let me start with some background to the context. Just about 2 years ago, The Atlantic magazine approached me and said, "We know you're not an originalist, so do you want to talk about your views on constitutional interpretation? But of course, we can only give you 1,500 words." Now, constitutional theory isn't actually my first love, so my chair title is a bit fraudulent in this regard. My first love is, my real passion is administrative law, and Cass Sunstein will understand me here. But I agreed to put down a few thoughts for The Atlantic, not realizing anything would come of it, and that was a mistaken view. So I sketched out some points I've been reading about and thinking about for some time, which was to say that American constitutional law had lost sight of its classical legal heritage, which was also the way the founding generation thought about law, and that a revival of the classical legal heritage could begin to cure the ills that both legal progressivism and legal conservatism, that is, conservative legal originalism, had inflicted on our legal system. Well, to my surprise and amusement, the internet immediately blew up when this piece was published. And this was all during Lent, no less, so it was an appropriate penance. And the outcry was deafening. Within less than 24 hours, The Atlantic had acquired and published two responses, one from a legal progressive and one from a libertarian originalist. These were Garrett Epps and Randy Barnett. And I thought it was very striking that both said in essentially identical terms that these ideas were dangerous. Part of the uproar involved people complaining that my brief piece had not offered a total comprehensive history and theory of constitutionalism. So I was forced to write this book and several follow-on pieces, some co-authored with an outstanding jurist from the University of Liverpool named Connor Casey. And these expand upon the original piece. I still don't purport to offer a theory of everything, but there's a project there. So let me explain the project a bit. Common good constitutionalism aims to recover and revive the very deep and long-standing connections between the classical American legal tradition on the one hand, and on the other, the classical Roman and more broadly Western legal tradition. The jus communis, of which the Anglo-American common law is best understood as a local variant. The book thus has both a general part and a particular part, the duality that is itself typical of the classical legal framework. It speaks both to general principles of common good constitutionalism and to the specific embodiment, or as we say in the jargon, determination of those principles in the American constitutional order. Now, those two are detachable in the sense
You can subscribe to the methodological framework without subscribing to my particular interpretations of American law. That's all up for contest within the methodological premises. Put another way, I think American legal theory suffers from a pervasive kind of amnesia. Aside from the work of a few legal historians and other specialists, our law has all but lost the memory of its own origins and formative influences in the classical legal tradition. Both the English and continental streams of the jus commune influenced Americans right from the beginning, through the founding era, through the 19th century, and well into the 20th. And my suggestion is that this American embodiment of the classical legal tradition should become once again the matrix within which American judges read our Constitution, our statutes, our public law. What we have forgotten, in brief, is that the positive law based on the will of the civil lawmaker, while worthy of great respect in its proper sphere, is contained within a larger objective order of background legal principles and standing aims of civil government. It is thus rightly interpreted in accordance with those principles, especially in hard cases in which legal texts are ambiguous, general, vague, or conflicting. If anything has a claim to capturing the original understanding of the Constitution, the classical legal tradition does. In fact, it just is the original understanding. This is how the framers thought about law. So-called originalism in its elaborated theoretical form is a product of a particular time and place. It's a product of the conservative legal movement's political and rhetorical situation after World War II, and especially in the 1960s and 1970s. Its underlying assumptions are essentially positivist, and thus from the standpoint of the founding era, they are anachronistic, indeed counter-originalist. Of course, a simple return to the particular rules of the classical tradition is neither desirable nor even possible, but the core theoretical insights and jurisprudential principles of that tradition can be adapted and translated into our world so as to yield a better interpretation of our own constitutional order. Those insights are not so remote that we can't recover them. In fact, they're quite close at hand. They're just obscured from our current vision. Key elements of the classical law remain vital within our law, even as legal theorists have ceased to defend or even recognize them. I saw a recent piece that missed this distinction. Well, our legal theory has lost sight of its own origins. It's no contradiction to say that in practice our law retains many classical elements. That's indeed how amnesia works. We are practicing better than we know. So what exactly does the classical legal tradition hold? The centerpiece of that tradition is that law should be seen as a reasoned ordering to the common good, an act of rational governance aimed to promote the good of citizens as members of a flourishing political community, and ultimately as members of the community of peoples and nations. All officials have a duty and corresponding authority to promote the common good, albeit, and this is crucial, in a manner consistent with the requirements of their particular roles. This classical conception embodies the best of our own tradition, the union of well-ordered reason with public authority. This approach takes enacted texts very seriously. They are products of the reasoned deliberation of public authorities who give specific content to the law, where background legal principles need specification or leave relevant issues to discretionary choice. Where at all possible, the classical view reads the law of a particular jurisdiction, the so-called jus civile, or law of the city, in light of the jus gentium, the law of nations and peoples, and the jus naturale, the natural law, which the civil law is taken to specify or again determine within reasonable boundaries. General background principles of law might, for example, say that at some point, peace and order require that potential defendants should have repose from the risk of being sued. It would then be up to the civil law in such an instance to determine a specific statute of limitations and to resolve the many questions that flow from it. So this implies two important things, of which one is often missed. The first thing it implies is that the judges or other officials who interpret the meaning of law at the point of application are duty-bound to follow a kind of textualism, at least presumptively. But this is not the positivist form of textualism that simply equates law with enacted texts, as Justice Gorsuch did in the Bostock decision. Rather, it is a different form of textualism, justified in a different way, on the ground that respect for the determinations of the public authority itself serves the common good. The second corollary, and this is crucial and sometimes missed, as I said, is that in hard cases where the positive law is indeterminate, or vague, internally conflicted, overly general, then enacted texts are always read against the backdrop of, and if possible in accordance with, this broader legal background of general and traditional legal principles, natural law, and the law of nations. The classical law itself incorporates positive law in this sense and justifies its role, but rejects any commitment to positivism in a jurisprudential sense. And unlike some presentations you will hear, it is very much alert to the inevitable limits of foresight on the part of legislators and other lawmakers, who will, by the bounded rationality of all of us humans, inevitably end up creating texts that need specification or completion or construction or interpretation in some way. I see no difference between those two. What then is the common good? The common good is, for the temporal purposes of the constitutional lawyer, the flourishing and happiness of the political community. It's capable of being shared without being diminished, so a humble analogy might be the victory of a sports team, which is the victory of the team as such, over and above the victory of the individual players, and isn't diminished by being shared among the players. The common good is also the highest good of individuals comprising the political community, for the simple reason that no man is an island. I want to read you this quote that I really like from Aquinas. He says, "The individual good is impossible without the common good of the family, state, or kingdom." Hence Valerius Maximus says of the ancient Romans that they would rather be poor in a rich empire than rich in a poor empire. They'd rather be poor in a rich empire than rich in a poor empire. I think maybe a simple diagnosis of America's ills in 2022 is that there are a lot of Americans who would, by contrast, rather be rich in a poor nation than be poor in a rich nation. Unfortunately, this seemingly clever approach turns out to be self-defeating. Even the goods of individual and family life, I think we've rediscovered, cannot be enjoyed in a decaying and chaotic polity, even if we can afford to live in a gated community or whatever. So the classical view is not at all that the common good is the good of the collective or aggregate as opposed to that of individuals. Quite the contrary. The common good of happiness in a flourishing political community is ultimately for the sake of individuals, because a flourishing community is the precondition for the goods of individual and family life, and the highest temporal good for individuals as such. Well, to give the common good more specific content, I draw upon the precepts of legal justice in the classical law: to live honorably, to harm no one, and to give each one what is due him or her in justice. These underpin the classical account of the central goods at which constitutionalism should aim, which is worked out elaborately in the tradition. These goods include, in a famous trinity, pax, justitia, and copia, peace, justice, and abundance, which I extrapolate to modern conditions to include various forms of health, safety, and economic security, and so on. I also elicit from the tradition key principles of solidarity and subsidiarity, although I read subsidiarity in a somewhat different way. Much more could be said here, but I have to be criminally brisk. Let me briskly move on to dispel a couple of myths and misconceptions. The common good is not preferences or what I like or whatever the judge feels like imposing on a Tuesday. So there's a claim one might hear that the only alternative to positive textual rules is a kind of unstructured discretion that just implements subjective preferences. But that is a deeply impoverished legal ontology, and it is not the ontology of the whole Western legal tradition. Until very recently, the Western legal tradition has supposed that other binding sources of law exist, that they have ascertainable content, they are objective. We might, of course, make mistakes about them, but they really do exist. And that when necessary, those sources can and should be drawn upon to determine legal meaning. And I recommend to you recent work that has explained in undeniable detail how this was the founder's conception of how law worked. Those other binding sources are not drawn upon in an unstructured way, but according to the morality of roles, which include presumptions of deference, respect for jurisdiction, and other devices for allocating authority. There is here no brief for judicial supremacy. A second point, in the classical legal tradition, rights very much exist. It's just that they're not defined in an essentially individualist, autonomy-based, and libertarian fashion that's so familiar today. Instead, rights are objective corollaries of justice, which is the constant aim of giving every person their due. In the classical tradition, both natural and positive rights are in somewhat different ways included within law's larger ordering to the common good. They need never be overridden in the name of the common good. That's not the picture. Because the ordering to the common good is built into the scope and point and interpretation of rights from the beginning. Okay, just a few words now about some of the leading modern competitors to the classical tradition. I mentioned at the outset this amnesia of our legal theory, and I think it's at least partly affected our legal practice, which now oscillates restlessly and unhappily between two dominant approaches, progressivism and originalism. In my view, despite their superficial enmity, these are both aspects or variants that flow from the same basic premises about law and political morality. Their apparent conflict is really a kind of duopoly. They are constitutional laws equivalent of the two-party system, if you will. Since its modern inception in the 1960s and 1970s, originalism has been unable to free itself from, or usually even to acknowledge, the implicit normative assumptions and judgments needed to attribute rationality to legal texts, to determine the level of generality which the meaning of text should be read, to resolve ambiguities, or otherwise make sense of their terms. Even putatively originalist decisions of the Supreme Court turn out to be richly interpreted and normative. They are shot through with implicit and explicit justification in light of claims about political morality. And the Bostock decision, which I mentioned, which expressly describes itself as an originalist decision, at a key moment hinges on a substantive and controversial claim about political morality. And this, for me, is an example of a larger point, which is that no law can operate without some implicit or explicit vision of the good to which law is ordered. The only questions are whether we are transparent about that or not, and which account of the good our law will promote, pursue, and endorse. Well, I'm just about done. Let me conclude with a few thoughts on why there has been a powerful revival of interest in the classical legal tradition. And in my experience, it's especially pronounced among law students, law clerks, and younger professionals, although I'm limited to them. Now, the real reason may, of course, just be the perpetual desire of the young to rise up against their elders. But I'll explore some other possibilities. One issue is the faltering of the alternatives. Originalism has fractured in interesting ways, especially at the academic level. There are now maybe a dozen increasingly recondite versions of the theory. They include original meaning originalism, expected applications originalism, original methods originalism, original law originalism, originalism as a standard of correctness rather than a decision procedure, and on and on and on. Amid this rather chaotic welter of competing versions of the theory, the claim of originalism's academic proponents to offer determinacy as opposed to the supposed manipulability of other alternatives, rings hollow. So too, originalism, I think in a certain way, has been undone by its own political success. If we are all originalists now, which is a commonly heard tagline, then we are also all non-originalists now. For originalism gives no specific differentiation. Just ask famous self-described originalist judges like Justices Kagan and Jackson. But I think the impetus behind the revival of classical law actually runs much deeper than the shortcomings of alternatives. I think it stems most fundamentally from the parlous state, not of law and legal theory, but of the larger polity. I suggest a kind of paradox. As a polity becomes increasingly disordered, increasingly remote from a flourishing commonwealth promoting peace, justice, and abundance, the claims of the common good and indeed the natural law actually become more visible, more insistent, and less debatable. It's easy to be fashionably skeptical about the claims of the common good when the polity is more or less basically functional. The intellectuals can focus on edge cases and recondite exceptions, and they can do that in comfort and safety because the main tasks of civil governance are being taken care of in the central cases. But when the polity is in a kind of undeniable decay, when disparities of wealth and inequalities of educational opportunity are pervasive, when fentanyls become the leading cause of death for adults between 18 and 45, when a million Americans die in an epidemic, when judges are harassed in their homes over cases they are currently deciding, in circumstances like these, I think it becomes ever more plausible that a flourishing polity is itself the highest good for individuals, this central claim of the classical tradition. And it becomes more plausible that there exist background principles of reasoned order that should themselves be part and parcel of our law. Just as absence makes the heart grow fonder, so too we perceive more keenly what our polity desperately lacks when we lack it. It's no accident, I think, that the last major revival of classical legal theory was after the Second World War, when the idea that positive law does not exhaust the binding sources of law was triumphantly vindicated at Nuremberg. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you to everyone for the warm reception this evening. The pleasure of joining this conversation, let's be honest, in a sea of insignificant events, frivolous, usually forgettable debates. How refreshing to spend an evening asking questions of consequence. It's been quite some time since $5 bought me such excitement. About 25 years, if I remember correctly. I was a law student, like many here, I'm guessing. The study of the law often lacked balance, avoided challenge, seemed to rigorously sidestep moral truth. A pamphlet tacked to a bulletin board offered an alternative. I was skeptical. Could I really sit with the foremost thinkers in the law just by putting a few singles in the mail? Indeed, I could. So with a creaking voice, trembling hands, I stood in rooms and heard the awesome and inspiring voices of Antonin Scalia, of Robert Bork. Stood and heard. I didn't participate, of course. I was a student. I was there to consider, to reflect, to wonder. It all went well. Well, maybe I'd do a little bit better in practice. Maybe, perhaps, I would be able to perform my small role as a participant in the legal process. Not a bad life, I recall thinking. And a good life it remains. But one, I think, that now requires some perspective. And that's what I want to share this evening, because when Professor Vermeil kindly asked if I could offer a response to this discussion, a response to the comments about the claims in his book, I thought, no. No, I cannot. Not because I'm shy, hardly. Not because of some regulation, certainly not out of fear. But because I see little role for most judges, maybe for all judges, in developing principles of law, let alone legal philosophy, outside of cases in
and controversy. And I believe there is great danger when we try. Begin with what is probably by now obvious. A robe and a commission does not confer intellect. I am honored to hold the same title as Judges Bork and Scalia, but I am neither. And as bright as many of my colleagues are on the federal bench, most aren't either. We may well wish it were otherwise. We may wish to see ourselves as heirs to their tradition, the new center of the debate they started, but that is foolish. They were, for a long time, professional scholars. Their job, their comfortable center, was the future of ideas. They simply stood on different footing. Most of us, well, we're just lawyers who, through a combination of timing and connections, wound up serving as judges. So, my advice, be careful how you view us. And ask whether it is really helpful to ask us judges to take on part-time work moonlighting as philosophers. What has that produced? What has conservative judicial writing conserved? I don't think it's a mystery. One is well-worn ground. Originalism begins as a political response, as the professor noted, in the early 1980s to the decisions of the Warren and Burke courts. Textualism emerges as a framework to disagree with the decisions of the D.C. Circuit in the late 1970s. Both were priorities of those two administrative law scholars, soon to be judges, who urged a narrow focus on the positive law as a substantively complete set of rules, hoping, it seems, to foster deference to political majorities. They would then jump from the campus quads to the executive branch, shuttling from Chicago and New Haven to Washington before settling onto the bench. And plenty more would follow them. But they didn't follow their path, did they? They didn't start as scholars and arrive on courts with experience in developing theory. Yet they were happy enough to accept the invitations and to sign on to the articles, to claim the mantle of Bork and Scalia without earning their academic medal. Shouldn't be surprising then that it soon became less about the doing of positivism than the nodding to the theory of positivism. That the opportunities for positivist judging would always just seem out of reach, that there would be no volumes of textualist or originalist decisions to study, that we would get nearly an entire generation who espoused adherence to philosophy at night without ever finding occasion to apply it during the workday. Call it the era of panel positivism. Respectfully, and we all know what judges mean when they start on that base, that era requires reconsideration. It also, I think, calls for a new normal for us judges, one that better fits with our competence and our oath. We should spend less time on the dais and more days in chambers, studying, learning, asking as we prepare decisions and not discussions whether we ought perhaps reconsider assumptions that have rarely been tested. The judge as student and not scholar is not afraid of fresh ideas. He is eager for the help, excited by the chance to move his decisions, if even in a single matter, closer to the classical principles of justice. Foundational principles, as Professor Vermeule writes, recognized in the Constitution with its call to preserve liberty, not to maximize individual choice, but as a teleological order, value to the good. Why would any serious student of the law skip or dismiss such a debate? When was the last time a scholar writing about theories of interpretation struck such a nerve? I can think of two. 1971, when Bork's Neutral Principles was published, 1997, when Scalia's Matter of Interpretation first appeared in book form. Call me old-fashioned, but I prefer the days when comfortable assumptions were challenged. When Bork could call the state of constitutional theory deplorable, and Scalia could describe the Mr. Fix-It-All mentality of the common law judge a short recipe for incompetence and usurpation. And conservatives, well, they cheered rather than cowering in internet quarters. True, some of Professor Vermeule's criticisms make us uncomfortable. Truth does have that effect. And in that disquiet, we judges have an opportunity to rest
as the professor identifies whether we have allowed the dual dangers of arrogance and skepticism to replace the law as our guide. To consider, as well, our neglect, contrary to the founders' ideals of law dependent on writers' steeped in classical and moral theory. That shouldn't be such a controversial claim. Even though 30 years ago this month, Judge Bork wrote that, quote, if there was evidence that the framers and ratifiers intended judges to apply natural law, well, then I would agree. A bit earlier, as it turns out, February 25th, 1775, as it were, Hamilton had occasion to recommend to your perusal Grotius, Pufendorf, Rolandoqui, citing just a few of the books and the authors that would be listed in Madison's report on books to Congress in 1783. I leave it to finders of fact how to weigh that evidence. But we cannot ignore it no longer. American public law, as Professor reminded us again tonight, he writes, suffers from a terrible amnesia. I'm not so sure our disorder is so fulminant, our symptoms so incurable, but I am sure that it is a condition that requires judicial fidelity to law as it exists, as it has always been understood, drawing upon the thick layer of reasoning and rationale common not only to our founding generation, but to the generations that inspired the founders to act. That alone will help avoid the errors of misinterpretation too easily introduced by modern readings of ancient texts, and clarify the meaning of the technical and specialized language obvious in the Constitution. So let's return to the classroom. By declining the role of public persona and embracing instead the privilege of humble and anonymous decision maker, judges, we are consumers of legal theory. Well-trained technicians, perhaps, but not much more. And as students, we should run to, not from, challenge and debate. Justice Scalia said it best, I think. He said, I am something of a contrarian, I suppose. I feel less comfortable when everybody agrees with me. I say, I better re-examine my position. I believe the worst decisions on my court have been unanimous because there's nobody on the other side pointing out all the flaws. Count me in. And count on the conclusion already evident that common good constitutionalism has quickly made its mark by reminding us of the classical approach to interpreting positive law. I, today and always, will have enduring respect for the lives, the contributions, for the service of Justice Scalia and Judge Bork. Those can never be questioned. But respecting their work, honoring their endless intellectual curiosity, demands we not ignore important questions raised by those best suited to question theory. Faithful and not fearful, as we re-examine answers that once seemed robust, relevant, even required. Hiding from that challenge? Well, that means hiding from our oath. The good, commonly known to republics before ours, and yet still today, demands at least that much. Thank you.
So I'm going to say thanks to Adrian and everyone for having me tonight, but I actually owe him a far greater debt than just this event. When I was in law school, I had just finished arguing in moot court and passed him in the hallway of the law school, and he said, have you ever thought about working at the SG's office? I said, no, I had never given that any thought. So to his illustrious resume, you can add career counselor, because it turned out to be pretty good. Decision, though if you had told me that my mild-mannered administrative law professor would become a celebrity on Twitter, I think I would have taken the bet. I have a great deal of trepidation about being here this evening. When Adrian invited me to do this and told me who else was participating, I said, so I just want to be clear. You want me to join a group of people who are all smarter than I am to discuss a subject about which you are all expert and I am entirely ignorant. He said yes, and then to confirm how dumb I am, I said yes. So I want to offer just a few thoughts as a practicing lawyer and leave the intellectual heavy lifting to the professionals. But first, I do want to take a minute to note how important it is that we're here. When I was in law school, the breadth of its umbrella and the vibrancy of the debates that occurred beneath it were strengths of the conservative legal movement. I remember reading dueling opinions from Judges Wilkinson and Luden on the Fourth Circuit, or Easterbrook and Posner on the Seventh. Maybe it's a sign of how far originalism and textualism have come, that perhaps legal conservatives have become complacent or begun to take certain tenets as orthodoxy, but in any event, it's a danger to guard against. Adrian and others are sparking an important debate. The right should have that debate, and we should do it with civility on both sides. So, on to my observations. As a practicing lawyer, common good constitutionalism seems pretty daunting at first cut. It's hard enough to brief text and structure and legislative history, but dividing the natural law with reference to Aristotle, Augustine, and Aquinas, that's pretty far beyond the ken of most of us. But it turns out that the common good wisely accounts for institutional constraints. And so, at least as I understand the theory, and I may be getting it wrong, judges should generally stick to the ordinary meaning of words, which seems like textualism, and defer to the reasonable policy choices of legislators and regulators, which seems like rational basis review and some form of administrative deference. Now, to be sure, Adrian justifies those principles differently, as he explained in his opening talk tonight. But so far, my briefs, or at least the briefs of the Department of Justice, don't look like they need to change very much. So what's the delta? I think there are several, but potentially the main one is the common good approach to executive power and the administrative state. So let me illustrate with an example. And I know it's statutory rather than constitutional, but I think the principles hold. The Occupational Safety and Health Act allows the Secretary of Labor to regulate, quote, occupational safety, end quote. OSHA, the agency, not the statute, mandated the COVID vaccine for all workplaces with more than 100 employees, roughly 84 million workers. So is COVID an occupational hazard? Now, a judge confronting that question might think the text isn't open and shut. Is an occupational hazard a danger that is unique to your work, or any danger that you confront at work, even if you also confront it everywhere else? Now, at that point, I think a textualist but not common good judge would do what the Supreme Court justices purported to do, try to divine the most natural meaning of words in context. For the conservative justices, the key contextual clue was that surrounding provisions refer to hazards only present in the workplace. For the liberal justices, that inference was not strong enough to impose any limit on the text of the relevant provision itself. But what should a common good judge do? I might be wrong, but I think Adrian would say the judge should defer to OSHA's mandate, and the Supreme Court therefore got it wrong. Then maybe that type of deference is not necessarily built into the common good, but it seems like an important part of Adrian's conception of the common good for reasons I'll come to in a minute. Now, I suspect he would say, look, what really drove the court's decision was a view about whether this was a matter sensibly entrusted to OSHA and whether OSHA had acted reasonably. And we would do better to have that type of debate directly. And therein lies much of the force of common good constitutionalism. To the extent that we're legal realists and values rather than methods drive decision making, better to have an honest debate about our values and to offer a moral conception that can compete with our opponents. But having acknowledged its force, I want to make a few observations about potential concerns. Imagine a judge who doesn't come at the question with a strong view either way and is genuinely at sea. It's far more manageable for me to brief and for the judge to study and decide. The textual clues and the natural meaning of a term like occupational than it is to brief and decide whether OSHA merits a role and has acted appropriately in the midst of a pandemic. Neither lawyers nor judges are trained to decide the latter, which feels not like legal work at all. I think the only way to avoid that problem is to build in something like a deference principle, so that the judge doesn't have to discern for himself or herself the common good by weighing the larger competing considerations in every case, or at least every important and close case. Now, textualism supplies a type of deference of sorts. If the best reading of the text is that occupational hazards are workplace related and not ever-present dangers, then the court is bound to respect or defer to that legislative policy judgment to deny authority to the agency. But I take Adrian's key move, and maybe the key move between the current prevailing version of textualism and common good judging, to be that where there's any doubt about the legislative policy judgment, the court should defer instead to the executive or regulatory policy judgment. The net result of that view, I think, is a ratchet in favor of the executive branch and agencies, which inevitably do the fleshing out of laws. And for conservative lawyers and legal thinkers, that might be like jumping from the frying pan into the fire, because for many, any conception of the common good builds in a strong skepticism of the government and a belief in freedom from regulation. That post-Enlightenment strand of our uniquely American DNA and experience may not be captured by looking only to the ancients. And speaking only for myself, I spent nearly a decade in an office that touched and reviewed work by many different pockets of the administrative state. The conception of administrator as Roman praetor, though noble and aspirational, does not match up with the vast bulk of my lived experience. There are reforms to the administrative state that would help, no doubt. But in the end, it may be that deference skews agencies' incentives, and even on Adrian's conception, could prevent the administrative state from ordering itself to the common good. I think there's a serious question whether, in the ways in which common good judging diverges from textualism and originalism, we might find that applying textualism and originalism alone actually achieves a greater common good. I'll mention one other difference, and that is there is a traditional rule dating back at least to the Supreme Court's decision in Mellon in the 1920s that states could not bring so-called parens patriae suits on behalf of their residents. Beginning with Massachusetts v. EPA in 2007 and in a string of cases over the last 15 years, the Supreme Court has effectively allowed states to end-run that Mellon rule. The states typically point to fairly nominal injuries that are derivative of the injuries to their residents. So for instance, think of Texas's claim in its lawsuit challenging DAPA and DACA that it was injured by the costs of giving driver's licenses to the immigrants subject to those policies. Treating those kinds of derivative injuries as sufficient for standing has resulted in a state of affairs where either red states or blue states can bring a host of legal challenges whenever the opposing party occupies the White House. Add in broad remedies like nationwide injunctions, and it's a recipe for an unending stream of politically charged cases that fly up to the Supreme Court. All of that seems only to enhance the power of courts vis-a-vis the other branches. I would have thought then that Adrian would be against it, but I was a little surprised to see in the final chapter a pitch for broadening the state's ability to sue. I don't know about broad remedies, but even an injunction limited to any number of states, and the number is usually substantial, can be enough to flummox the executive branch. The net effect, I think, seems to be, but again, I may be misunderstanding, opening the courthouse doors to a larger number of intergovernmental suits where judges are in turn supposed to defer to the executive. Based solely on my practical experience, I have some skepticism about whether putting those questions in front of courts encourages the kind of humility that deference may require. In any event, I came away from the book wondering just how important courts are supposed to be in a common good world. And I look forward to hearing Adrian's reactions on that, as on everything else. Thanks.
Before I just begin some brief comments, I'm aware of how much work went into this evening behind the scenes, and unlike certain other institutions in this town, we don't have an army of interns and underpaid recent college graduates doing all the work putting this together. This was almost entirely, this evening, was the work of one man who is now the father of two newborn twins. Would you join me in thanking Chad Pagnon? Thank you, Chad, for everything you've done, and it is very much appreciated. This is now for something completely different. Everyone's claiming they're the unique individual on this panel, but I am the unique individual. I don't hold a law degree and never will hold a law degree if God is blessing me. And so I can't and I won't necessarily speak on the central theme of the book, but in some ways I want to talk on the theme beneath the theme. And I want to do this by talking about the world historical significance and importance of the life course of a major and important American life. Yes, I want to speak of somebody who spent many years living in Boston, a kind of Boston Ramin, as they have been known. Someone who traveled in the highest, most elite, effete circles of Boston society. Someone who was ensconced in the bosom of New England fashionable society. And this personage did the unthinkable. He converted to Catholicism. He became a fierce proponent of his new faith with the zeal of a convert, attempting to convince anyone who he came across of the truth of his beliefs, and even occasionally was criticized and scolded for the meanness of what he wrote. Salty retorts and sharp criticisms. He had a very mean pen. As a Catholic, and as a convert, and as an American Catholic, he wavered a bit between thinking that America was inveterately hostile terrain to his faith and to the deepest traditions and philosophy of his faith. A land that had been founded by Protestants, that was fundamentally undergirded and underpinned by a philosophy, the liberal philosophy, that was contrary to the classical Aristotelian Thomistic tradition, the medieval classical tradition as a whole. But then also thinking that in some ways there was a kind of way in which America, in a kind of different way, was more fundamentally in continuity with that pre-modern, pre-Enlightenment tradition. And of course I'm speaking, as I've seen a few of you whispering to each other, I'm speaking of Orestes Brownson. For those of you who don't know Orestes Brownson, you should know Orestes Brownson. Orestes Brownson was arguably, perhaps still remains, the most important convert to Catholicism in American history, and without a doubt was the most important convert to Catholicism in the 19th century. He lived between the years 1803 through 1876, so much of the 19th century, and entered the church in midstream in 1844. This is someone who hobnobbed and hung out with and was best pals with Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, and who would still be spoken of in the same tones of reverence and respect as those figures had he not done the unthinkable and entered the Catholic Church. Now there's a remarkable similarity between Orestes Brownson, beyond what I've already mentioned, Orestes Brownson and Adrian Vermeule, who entered the church. Which is that there's a Notre Dame connection. I couldn't be up here without mentioning the Notre Dame connection, of course. I always assign my students, no matter what class I'm teaching, a few of them are out here tonight, and during the semester I say, go find out where Orestes Brownson is buried on campus, and you're not allowed to look it up on the internet. And some of them who actually respect my assignment come back and say, I looked in all three cemeteries around campus and I couldn't find it. And I said, you didn't look in the one spot where we bury people on Catholic campuses, which is in the crypt. Orestes Brownson is the only person buried in the crypt that's below the Basilica of the University of Notre Dame. He had been invited by the then president of Notre Dame to teach at Notre Dame, but didn't make it. He got as far as Detroit and caught cold and passed away. And so the university, wanting to at least have some sort of remnant, as it were, of Orestes' significance, asked his family if they could disinter him and bring him to Notre Dame and bury him on our campus. If we couldn't have him as a teacher, we'll have him in our crypt. This was how important he was to American Catholicism. Now, Adrian, we hope, is, you know, we're not going to discuss this possible journey but it was the case that, Adrian entered the church at Notre Dame in a mass that I attended. I was very blessed to attend. I didn't know Adrian at the time, and actually when I met him, I thought, well, this guy's not going to amount to much. He's really quiet and not that bold. You can't always tell someone from their first impressions. Brownson's post-conversion life, if you know Brownson, he was prolific. He just produced volumes upon volumes, that 19th century way of writing, sentences that go on for books. But Brownson, much of his post-conversion life, was an effort to find and try to discover the way to reconcile Catholicism and America. Were these two finally reconcilable? And perhaps this was articulated most fully in his book, The American Republic. In this book, which was republished by Intercollegiate Studies Institute a number of years ago, with a really important introduction by the late, great Peter Augustine Lawler, Brownson made a version of an argument that has appeared and reappeared at various points in American history, which is in effect the argument that the founders, unbeknownst in some ways to themselves, were appealing to a tradition that was longer and deeper, to the tradition that they believed they were appealing to. That they often stated their arguments in terms of Enlightenment liberal principles. You see that, of course, in the Declaration of Independence. But in fact, were appealing to and were based upon a much deeper pre-modern tradition. The famous phrase, they built better than they knew, is often associated. He didn't say it, Brownson didn't say it, but it's often associated to summarize the sentiment of Brownson's arguments. And this was an argument that was picked up many years later by John Courtney Murray in his book, We Hold These Truths, and was also articulated, as I mentioned, by Peter Augustine Lawler, who passed away almost 5 years ago to the day today, someone whose voice I think we miss a great deal. Now, Brownson's was one of a number, and what continued to be a number of efforts to describe how to reconcile those liberal strands of the American founding and of the American tradition, and to reconcile it with some idea or ideal of America as compatible with a pre-modern, a classical tradition. These include the rather, let's just say, incredible set of claims that we can read Locke as a good Catholic. I don't recommend either reading or attempting these arguments, but they're out there. Or since Pedro here in the front row, of course, the effort to claim that the American founding was actually Columbus, and we are actually a Spanish country. The Mississippi River was originally called the River of the Immaculate Conception. And of course, many of the cities in what is now America have same names like San Francisco and San Diego and so forth. Until very recently, this was also the effort and attempt by Notre Dame, if you know the main building of Notre Dame, it once sported large murals of the life of Christopher Columbus as kind of Notre Dame's effort to claim that we were here first. But we've covered those up now, so we're not making those sorts of claims anymore. Now, so why all this discussion of Brownson? Having read Adrian's book, actually in galleries, and given a blurb for it, I'll echo what I said there. I think this is not just the most significant book, but I think it's the most significant book by possibly the most significant American Catholic convert since Brownson. And that includes some pretty significant company. Because he is attempting to do what Brownson did, but in a bolder way, which is to argue through this argument, through this book, Common Good Constitutionalism, that America has and continues to be based in a classical tradition, the classical legal tradition, that stretches back as far and as long ago as Rome, which includes the long Middle Ages, the Roman tradition as it was transmitted through the Catholic and Christian Middle Ages, that manifested itself in Europe and found its way to the United States. This is a bold set of claims that goes further than Brownson was willing to go. In other words, Brownson and many of the heirs of Brownson argued that while the American founding claims to be liberal, it was in fact, there was something deeper, there was a providential constitution. And Adrian is claiming that in fact, it was always a classical tradition, self-consciously so. The boldness of this claim gives rise, at least to my mind, of a question. It's a question that I've asked Adrian in various ways, but I'll ask it in public. How do we, in some ways, claim that this is our tradition when we also can see and we can witness that there is also an obvious liberal, enlightened strand of the American tradition, the one that's arguably responsible for a lot of the catastrophes that Adrian described toward the end of his talk? So the question that a political theorist might ask the law professor, or a Catholic political theorist might ask the Catholic law professor, would be the following. I would love to believe every word of your book, but can we rightly hope that a bolder articulation of America's classical tradition that makes compatible a pre-modern tradition emanating from Rome, both Romans in a sense, will be more successful in restoring, in some ways, in a restoration that allows us to be true to ourselves? Does it have more prospects for success than those prospects that Brownson himself hoped he might have? Will the boldness of your claims have more chance of a success in a country that seems to be so far now from that classical pre-modern tradition that it is increasingly difficult in some ways to see it or discern it as genuinely ours? That would just be my question to you, and I hope that we'll have opportunity now and in many years to come to discuss these questions.
And now we turn our attention to the screen for a video presentation from Judge LeBlanc.
I
want to
begin by thanking Professor O'Neill for inviting me to speak. I'm grateful to get to do this for the same reason that I'm proud to be a frequent longtime speaker at Federalist Society events. One of Bedsock's greatest virtues is its hunger to debate and engage with ideas from across the jurisprudential and ideological spectrum. They always try to pair guest speakers with respondents who see things from a different angle. 40 years of dialogue across the intellectual divides have made us stronger and sharper, and that's why I regret having to miss this event. As a judge, I've always been a formalist because I believe my job is to respect and apply the rules laid down by lawmakers, even when I would have made different rules if I were in their shoes. Specifically, I'm an originalist and a textualist. As a judge interpreting written laws, I'm bound by the meaning those laws would have had to the public at the time of adoption. Something that strikes me about Professor Vermeule's work on judicial role is how much common ground I believe he shares with originalists like me. We agree that a legal text and its original meaning are crucial for judges. I believe that we agree that the principles enshrined in the Constitution don't change over time, even if they have to be applied to new facts and unforeseen circumstances. Judges are not licensed to revise those principles to fit their own or anyone else's new understanding of progress or even justice. That sort of living constitutionalism is unsound. It transforms judges into something that they are not supposed to be, legislators, and indeed super legislators. We agree that a legal system can and often should create a division of labor when lawmakers act on their moral and policy judgments, and judges apply these judgments in resolving disputes. We agree that there is a presumptive duty for everyone, judges included, to respect the constitutional scope and limits of their authority and stick to the law of a decent legal system, rather than depart from it to pursue goals they believe rightly or wrong to be allowed. In fact, the natural moral law itself favors the rule of law over the rule of judges. Professor Vermeule quotes Aquinas on this score, who in turn repeated Aristotle's statement that, quote, "It is better that all things be regulated by law than left to be decided by judges," end quote. In other words, the natural law itself imposes limits on judicial discretion to enforce what they, again, rightly or wrongly, may believe the natural law requires. And Aquinas gives several reasons for this, all embraced by Professor Vermeule. Consider two. First, it's easier to choose the overall best policy when you think about a wide range of cases at once, as lawmakers do, than when you focus on one fact pattern at a time, as judges like I do in resolving the particular dispute before them. Judges get hard cases, and hard cases make bad law. Second, judges making up rules on the spot might be swayed by their personal prejudices about this or that party, for this or that outcome, whereas lawmakers shaping general rules for the future can be more objective and dispassionate. For these and other reasons, Aquinas says it is, quote, "necessary whenever possible for the law to determine how to judge and for very few matters to be left to the decision of men," end quote. And that's remarkable. What's remarkable is that these are the same reasons that have historically loomed large in scholarly and political movements supporting textualism and originalism. Professor Vermeule cites this passage and dozens of others from Aquinas, and if I were with you now, I would welcome his thoughts on one more, a passage that seems to embrace formalism not only for the prudential reasons I just mentioned, but as a matter of so it may pose a challenge to Professor Vermeule's critiques on certain kinds of formalism, which is why I'm eager to hear his reflections. In the passage I have in mind, Aquinas talks about what should happen if a criminal defendant is innocent and the judge knows it. He knows it based on privately acquired evidence. While all the admissible evidence suggests the defendant is guilty, in that case, Aquinas says, the judge cannot override procedural law to reach the substantively just outcome of acquittal. After all, he is judging not as a private person who happens to be holding a gavel, but as an official with publicly defined limits on his power. One of those limits is to rule based on the lawfully created record. So that, Aquinas insists, is what the judge must do. Of course, the punishment of a person who is in fact innocent is a terrible evil, and it would make any judge shudder. Aquinas knew that. But he taught that the burden of preventing the unjust result falls on those with the proper authority. A DA's lawful discretion not to prosecute, a governor's lawful authority to pardon, or officials tasked with involving rules of procedure. In some cases, the law itself gives judges the discretion to make exceptions to certain rules to avoid bad outcomes, and in such cases, they should certainly use them. But the law doesn't always give judges this power, and that matters. For Aquinas, just as the common good is harmed by bad results, it's harmed when officials overstep their authority to achieve good results. There are bad means to good ends, even the good end of preventing an unjustified, and in that sense, objectively unjust punishment. I'd love to hear Professor Vermeule's thoughts on this discussion from Aquinas and much else. And that is why I am again sorry to miss this event and eager to watch it when it is available. Thank you.
Extremely interesting comments, and give me a lot to think about, and I will continue to think about them, but just a few off-the-cuff responses, if I may. I think I'll begin in absentia with Judge Lepar, because he, you know, specifically invited me to respond, and I want to thank him for his thoughts and for the ironic spirit in which they're offered. And in the same spirit, I'll say that I agree with them as far as they go. But the problem is that Aquinas also adds a crucial qualification, which the judge did not mention. So let me explain. As I say in the book, the baseline classical presumption is respect for the ordinary meaning of text. And in most cases, this will look much like it does now. Jeff is correct about this. But that's simply because most cases in law are easy. They are not the cases we see at the Supreme Court. But it is inevitable that hard cases will arise in which the positive law is not determinant. It's ambiguous, vague, or conflicting, and this because of the limits of legislative foresight that I mentioned. And this is exactly why Aquinas, who understood this just after the passages that Judge Lepar cites, goes on to say that observance according to the letter of the law is defeasible when in hard cases the lawmaker has failed to foresee a case in which the letter of the law doesn't capture background principles of the common good, or is ambiguous, or in some of the way it fails. And in such cases, Aquinas thinks there's no alternative but for the judge to judge in accordance with those principles rather than the ambiguous or vague or in some sense overbroad and therefore defective letter of the law. Now, on the classical conception, this isn't departing from the law in any way. That's a mischaracterization. It is doing law, the law includes not only the letters on a page, but it includes principles given to us by reason, by the aims of civil government, and by the nature of human beings and their concerns and what helps them to flourish. And this is emphatically the founder's conception of law. Judge Lepar also points to another passage in which Aquinas says that a judge possessed of private information about a criminal case must only judge in accordance with the evidence of public record. And he takes that as an argument for a kind of formalism in the modern sense. Here too, I think Aquinas' full view is quite otherwise. That first of all, Aquinas is referring here to what we would call specific adjudicated fact, not anything to do with law. No one's ever suggested that judges should be allowed to rely on non-record information as to specific adjudicated facts, especially not in a criminal case. But there's a more fundamental problem. The issue Aquinas discusses there has nothing to do with legal formalism, and the reason is, in the classical view, law is never a matter of private information. The natural law in the classical view is profoundly public. It's written on the hearts of all men. It's accessible to the reason of all. And that's why later in the same passage, Aquinas goes on to say this. He says, what a judge, I'm quoting now, what a judge knows as a public person comes to him through public laws, whether divine or human. So the interpretation of the law is never drawn on private information. It's an exercise of the judge's public function in which the judge participates in this larger objective order that is accessible to all. So, with thanks to Judge Lepar, I think I agreed with whatever he said, but it just didn't go far enough and left out the crucial twists. For Judge Mahee, I want to thank him for his very insightful remarks. I think they're terribly important, and I mostly want to underscore the disjunct between academic theory and actual legal practice that Judge Mahee points to, including the practice of judges. Our operative law is far less positivist than our legal theory suggests, and I'm going to get to this in a second as a thought for Jeff as well. I see this disjunct between theory and practice as both a problem and a promise. The problem is that academic theorists are deeply reluctant to acknowledge that our operative law is far less positivist than they would have it. I mean, that itself suggests that their theories are less relevant than they would hope. The promise, however, is that we can more easily recover from our legal practice, what I take to be the right approach, which respects positive law as far as it goes, but is not positivist in a theoretical sense. And some of this, I think, helps me respond to Jeff as well. When we talk about originalism and textualism, we need, I think, to look less at what the academics say these things ought to be, and more at what the judges actually do, which is why I was actually glad that Jeff brought up the OSHA case. But I don't recognize Jeff's description of it in any way. I think the OSHA case, the vaccine mandate case, is not only pervaded by, but expressly calls upon highly ambitious principles of political morality in the decision of the case. It is the farthest thing from the judges simply sitting down and trying to figure out the ordinary meaning of the text. So let me mention the Gorsuch concurrence in the OSHA case. This is for three judges, so you need these three judges to make a majority in the case. And let me quote to you for a second from what Justice Gorsuch says. He says that the case is to be decided on the basis of a principle, the major questions doctrine that he invokes. And at a certain point, he tells us what is the point of this major question principle. And he says it serves to prevent government by bureaucracy from supplanting government by the people. Now that seems to me a highly substantive, highly ambitious claim about political morality and what serves the common good and what doesn't. It is not lawyering down in the weeds, as it were. And our Supreme Court opinions are full of this, and they are full of this from the judges who self-identify as originalists, as Justice Gorsuch does. So I don't quite recognize Jeff's picture out there, and I want to emphasize that, in my view, whether or not Gorsuch's proposition is correct is entirely beside the point. That is, I'm happy to have a discussion substantively within the terms that Gorsuch has said, and my view would be that it's probably wrong or at least fatally incomplete, and the reason is that throughout American history, government by bureaucracy has been the way, the mechanism by which government by the people has been effected. That is, the people have used bureaucracy to control corporations that were oppressing them, to enforce antitrust laws, to do other things, to clean up their air and their water, do other things that they felt would help their lives flourish. So on the merits, I think I would disagree with Justice Gorsuch, but my point is, he is not involved in a different sort of exercise than the classical lawyers were. Okay. I wanted then to say a brief word to Patrick in conclusion. Patrick, thank you for your very interesting remarks. I take them as the remarks of a political theorist, one of our nation's, in my view, best political theorists, who has unfortunately been called upon to read a book by a lawyer. I'm sorry that we put you in this position, but I appreciate it. I fully
agree that at the level of political theory, the founding contained multiple strands, some liberal, some non-liberal. The founding was, of course, a coalition of people and ideas that knew what they were against in some sense, and then had the problem of figuring out what they were for. But that is all at a higher level of theory than the legal principles that the founders used. So it is, the claim in the book is that at the time of the founding and later, the founders' legal cosmology was the same as the classical legal cosmology. That is, they thought there was positive law, civil law, natural law, divine law. All these things are expressed in Blackstone, the main textbook, and James Wilson, I mean, everywhere. Now we have a problem that later in American history, what happened? Why is it that around World War I, this legal cosmology shifts with people like Holmes? And there is absolutely a story to be told about how the influence of liberalism at the level of theory starts to corrode this legal cosmology and then triumphs after World War II. But I don't think that there is anything inevitable about that. I think it's something that happened. And I see no reason why it's impossible to remind people of the different legal cosmology, especially when I claim that it's embedded in our practice. And when I also claim, I think that it becomes, as I said at the end of my talk, it becomes ever more salient and pressing and insistent the farther we are away from a flourishing polity. So I guess I'm not surprised at this revival. And I think to some degree it may be that the wheel is simply turning in light of new contingencies.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Well, I promised you Prussian discipline, but we are in fact running on Persian time. We are 15 minutes over.